Hey there, podcast listener. This is Meg Malone, VPR's digital producer, and I am just letting you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity, keeping it to the point. So let's get started.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinsel. The 10 leading Democratic presidential candidates debated the key issues of their campaign last night at an event in Houston. Healthcare was a major topic of that debate. Former Vice President Joe Biden made it very clear that he does not support Senator Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan, a plan that would provide universal access to healthcare and be paid for by federal taxes instead of private health insurance premiums. It's a plan that Sanders says won't have any deductibles or co-payments. But Biden disagreed with this analysis.
There will be a deductible in your paycheck. You're going to, the middle class person, someone making 60 grand with three kids, they're going to end up paying $5,000 more. They're going to end up paying 4% more on their income tax. That's a reality. Now, it's not a bad idea if you like it. I don't like it.
How do things stand after the third Democratic debate? We've got a great panel here today to discuss these issues. With us, Linda Fowler, who is a professor of government emerita at Dartmouth College, Matt Dickinson, political science professor at Middlebury College, and also Ted Cohn, who's the chairman of the College of Liberal Arts at Norwich University. Great to have you all on the program today. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Bob.
Yeah, it's good to be here. I think
great
we did
be here,
this
Bob.
Before, and it was fun.
That's good. Well, just to start off with, I'd love to go around the table and get your thoughts about what you feel were some of the most important moments of the debate last night. What are some of the things that this third Democratic debate is going to be remembered for? Linda Fowler, what do you think?
Well, I was looking to see whether Warren and Sanders could explain just how the universal health coverage would work in practice. I think there are legitimate questions about the cost, and I think they're having a difficult time because it's a complicated calculation about people's taxes going up, people's insurance going down, people's salaries maybe going up if employers no longer have to pay for this. And I didn't think they've done a very good job in the last two debates. And so I was thinking after more reflection and more time on the campaign trail, they would have come up with a clearer explanation of how it would work. And I didn't hear that.
And do you think that it, by not doing that, it leaves some confusion in the voters' minds?
I think it leaves confusion. I think it also leaves them open to concerns among a key demographic that they any Democrat has to win this year, and that is suburban women who are fearful about change in their in a fundamental thing like health care.
Matt Dickinson, what do you think last night will be remembered for?
Well, in addition to the issue that Linda raises quite correctly, I think, there are certainly moments that social media has picked on. I don't think those necessarily have long-term repercussions. For me, one of the interesting things going forward is how the field continues to get winnowed. We've seen candidates beginning to drop by the wayside and where their support goes. So I was looking at the performance of the second-tier candidates who really had most at stake last night. And I thought Julian Castro's attack on Biden and the implicit attack on his age, it was a risky strategy, but it reflects, I think, his calculation that something dramatic has to happen for him to break into that upper tier. The other four bottom candidates decided to go positive and accentuate their strengths while not attacking. And they all had really good moments. Unfortunately for them, that means it's not clear any one of them is necessarily going to break out of the pack.
Matt, do you think that Castro went too far?
I think it was a high-risk strategy, and the survey suggests there is concern about Biden's age, a concern accentuated by his gaffes, although people tend to forget even when he was younger, he was gaffe-prone. On the other hand, you know, there's a virtue in staying positive and not personalizing this. And you saw the pushback against Castro, not necessarily only from Biden, but from the other Democrats on the stage saying, you know, this is kind of beneath us. So we'll have to see how the polling plays out. But my inclination is it probably didn't help him, Castro, that is.
And for listeners who might not have seen that segment, Castro was asking Biden if he could remember something that he said he had said 2 minutes before.
Correct. It was a reference to whether you could buy in under Biden's health care plan or whether you were automatically enrolled. And this gets to Linda's point about the complicated nature of these issues. It turns out if you're below a certain income level, you're automatically enrolled, although you have to you're automatically qualified, although you have to enroll. But, you know, the factual basis was almost lost in the back and forth here. It turns out that Castro was probably wrong in accusing Biden of misstating his position. I'm not clear that that really mattered one way or the other, so much as the idea here was he was criticizing Biden for his age.
Ted, what do you think last night will be remembered for?
I was struck by perhaps the 11th person on the stage last night, and that was Barack Obama. I was struck by a clear calculation among several of the candidates who previously had gone after Obama's legacy as a proxy for going after Vice President Biden, who made a point really of saying how much they praised and how much they owed to the legacy of Barack Obama, and Julian Castro saying, no, no, I'm really the person who wears the mantle of the Obama administration. And so in a pretty short period of time, I think a number of the campaigns have realized that they were alienating a key demographic inside the Democratic Party by going after President Obama, namely African Americans and especially older African Americans. So Barack Obama is back in the good graces of a number of the progressives in the Democratic Party.
And what happens when some of the other candidates say, hey, hold on there, Mr. Vice President, you know, you take credit for the good stuff of Barack Obama, but, you know, you blame it on him when something goes wrong?
Yeah, I mean, this is the double-edged sword of being a vice president and saying that you're adhering to the legacy of the previous person. You know, how do you emerge from being the number two position? How do you emerge as the alpha? And I think this is going to be Biden's opponent's strategy of trying to, you know, praise Barack Obama, but also saying, especially the progressives, that the Obama legacy did not go far enough and we're trying to complete the job that the Obama administration started.
Let's go to our callers and start with Steve, who's calling from Bethel. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. Thank you.
And what's on your mind today, Steve?
I'm sorry. Yeah, so I just want to circle back around to the statement that one of your analysts said about the issue of the health care costs between the plans of Sanders and Warren versus Biden being confusing to voters. To me, as a middle-class voter who spent over $22,000 last year in health insurance premiums and deductibles, if the worst-case scenario that Joe Biden can come up with in terms of attacking that plan for cost is that I might spend $5,000 more in taxes, then it's very clear in my mind. I'm not confused at all which direction I would go.
All right, Steve, thanks very much for your phone call. During that health care debate, Sanders maintained that once employers don't have to pay insurance premiums for their employees, these companies will give their employees higher wages. But Joe Biden took issue with this idea and reminded people that Sanders supports many democratic socialist plans. And here's how this part of the debate unfolded.
My friend from Vermont thinks that the employer is going to give you back if you negotiated his union all these years, got a cut in wages because you got insurance. They're going to give back that money to the employee?
Matter of fact, they will.
Well, let me tell you something. For a socialist, you got a lot more confidence in corporate America than I do.
You got to defend the fact that today, not only do we have 87 million people uninsured and underinsured, you got to defend the fact that 500,000 Americans are going bankrupt.
Matt Dickinson, does this exchange highlight Biden's efforts to differentiate his more moderate policies with those of Sanders and probably by extension Senator Elizabeth Warren because she also supports the Medicare for All plan?
I think we saw that in his opening remark. He was called on first, that he immediately pivoted to this Medicare for All issue and linked Bernie together with Senator Warren. And, you know, there's a twofer here. One is, of course, is this a feasible issue? And is, once you get out of the Democratic primary, is this something that you want to run on successfully in the general election where you're going to have more independents and moderate voters? How well is this going to do against a Donald Trump who's going to claim this is socialism if you adopt Bernie's approach here? But the other thing is, and it wasn't just Biden. You saw all the second-tier candidates, the ones who were perhaps more moderate, emphasize the importance of choice, and all of them making a similar argument, which I think is a very effective argument, which is Bernie's heart is in the right place. Our ultimate goal is a single-payer health system, but you're not going to get there by taking away choice. And the best way to get there, and Buttigieg made this clear, is you have a public option on the table and you allow voters to choose which route they want to take to get health insurance, and over time, the most efficient route will prove to be the winner. I think that is a problem with both Warren and Sanders' plan, this idea that they're taking away choice, that they're going to have to address.
Matt, I'm glad you mentioned that, because the next cut we wanted to go to was, in fact, Mayor Buttigieg. As you said, he supports the idea of Medicare for all who want it. It should be a public option, he says, for people to choose. And here's how he explained it and how Sanders responded.
It doesn't trust the American people. I trust you to choose what makes the most sense for you, not my way or the highway. Now, look, I think we do have to go far beyond tinkering with the ACA. I propose Medicare for all who want it. We take a version of Medicare, we make it available for the American people, and if we're right, as progressives, that that public alternative is better, then the American people will figure that out for themselves. I trust the American people to make the right choice for them. Why don't you?
Medicare for all is comprehensive health care, covers all basic needs, including home health care. It allows you to go to any doctor you want, which many private insurance company programs do not. Moving to Medicare for all is the way to go.
Ted Cohn, does that exchange there kind of capsulize the difference between the more moderate view in the Democratic Party and the progressive wing over health care?
Yeah, I think so. Set aside Bernie Sanders' scratchy throat and his kind of angry uncle routine, I think, Pete Buttigieg did a great job sounding almost conservative and saying that, you know, why don't you trust the American people to make these choices? Why is government making it for you? I think it was a fantastic moment for Mayor Pete, and it just goes back to what Linda was saying. If in all of these months, if Warren and Sanders have not figured out a way to explain to the American people how Medicare for All is going to work, how we're going to pay for it, what it's going to cover, then when are they going to figure this out? And I think that was exactly a great moment for Mayor Pete to kind of, you know, to say Medicare for all who want it, to show that divide between Warren and Sanders and the rest of the field.
Linda, Mayor Buttigieg used the word trust, that the government doesn't trust folks to be able to make the right choice. But is there also an element of trust that perhaps some people don't trust the government to run something as important as their health care?
Oh, absolutely. Although people are confused about it. You remember the famous remark during the 2010 Tea Party things, don't let the government get its hands on my Medicare. But there's a larger issue. In the past, there's some really good political science that work that's been done about the connection between trust and expanding the social safety net. And in periods of low trust, it's very difficult to get people to agree to expand government. We're in a low trust period right now. The fact of the matter is that for people to willingly extend benefits to people that don't currently have them and perhaps assume some burden for paying toward them, they want to be assured that the government will do the right thing with the money. And I think that selling something like Medicare for All, the trust issue is really critical. And that's why I was watching it last night. I want to just remind people, maybe a lot of your listeners are on Medicare, but most people on Medicare have a private option. They usually have a Medigap policy. And so the idea that you're going to, you know, put all of the healthcare eggs in the federal basket, I think is going to be a hard swallow for a lot of voters who might otherwise choose Democrats this year.
And Linda, if you look at the single payer plans in Canada and in England and in Australia, you'll also see a private health insurance market.
Yeah, that's correct. The larger problem that comes out of this whole debate is the Democrats have to put together a coalition that is really problematic. They need to mobilize black voters who didn't turn out for Hillary. They need to mobilize young voters. Both of those segments of the electorate are quite progressive. They also need to take advantage of the trend that emerged in 2018 congressional elections of college-educated women and men. And then they need to mobilize Latino voters who are somewhere in the middle between really progressive and more fiscally conservative. And what I heard last night is the Democrats are more concerned about access. There was some great eloquence about structural racism in our society, which is right on the money, but it's not something that a lot of Democrats necessarily embrace.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Trish, who's calling from Amherst, Massachusetts. Hi, Trish. Welcome to the program.
I just have a fairly quick comment. I'm calling regarding the Medicare issue and Elizabeth Warren both. I think the problem with, as Pete Buttigieg said, trust the American people, is that you get, if you have private insurance and you have a Medicare option, the sickest people are going to go to the Medicare option, and then you have the government overloaded with the sickest people. I don't understand why we can't tip that on its head and say, we have a Medicare for all insurance system, like Canada, for example, and we allow private insurers for something like a Medigap policy. I'm on Medicare, and I have plenty of choice. I choose my own doctor. I can go to whatever hospital I want because I've got not a Medicare Advantage plan, but a Medigap policy, which I pay for at far less cost than I paid when I was on private insurance. So I have plenty of choice. The final thought I have is, I am obviously on Medicare, so I'm in my mid-60s. I am so tired of voting for male presidents that when you have somebody as qualified as Hillary was, and now you have somebody as qualified as Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris, it's almost impossible to get me to the poll to vote for a guy. And I hate saying that, but that's the truth. Thank you so much for my call.
All right, Trish, thanks very much for your phone call. Linda, there was something you said just before we went to break that I think is maybe the central issue of the 2020 presidential campaign, and that is, is the best strategy for the Democrats to win the White House to appeal to moderate voters, some of whom might have voted for Trump in 2016? Or should the party nominate a more progressive candidate who will energize this new base of the party and result in massive turnout for that Democratic candidate? Fire up the base or appeal to the centrist voters? Is that what it comes down to, Linda?
Well, I think that's a really tough issue. It's one the Democratic Party litigated during the Clinton years, and the moderates prevailed. And so it's not surprising that it's reemerging now as the Republican Party undergoes a very significant realignment, that it wouldn't. It makes sense that the Democrats need to figure out how their party coalition. Is it really more progressive? I remain skeptical, but maybe it's just because I've been watching this debate for many, many years. And in the end, the progressives will say if they that Hillary lost because she wasn't bold enough. And it's hard to see the evidence in the public opinion polls that just tap into general attitudes of American voters, that there hasn't been a sea change in Democratic constituencies. There has been in the Republican constituency, and that's the real issue. What, you know, can the Democrats exploit that change in the Republican Party? And I right now, I don't know.
And Ted, there's an argument that some Democrats are making that the party was able to take control of the U.S. House in 2018 because it did run moderate candidates in districts that Donald Trump carried in 2016. I think there are 35 or 40 seats that they won with those kinds of dynamics. So how does that affect the presidential race?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, we talk a lot about AOC and the progressives, but of course they won primaries in safe Democratic seats. The reason that the Democrats won back the House was because they won swing districts. And so this is exactly, I think, the challenge for Democrats going into 2020. And I share Linda's skepticism about the depth of this progressive revolution in the Democratic Party. How much was the Tea Party a reaction simply to the psychic shock of the election of Barack Obama? How much is the progressive reaction in the Democratic Party a response to the psychic shock of Hillary Clinton's loss to Donald Trump? And we're also seeing this playing out in a very real way day to day in the debate that's going on inside the House over the question of impeachment. And so is Nancy Pelosi and House leaders are going to allow an activist base inside the Democratic Party to push the House of Representatives on the eve of the 2020 election towards impeachment proceedings against Donald Trump, which he's certainly going to survive because the Republicans control the Senate, thus handing the Republicans and Donald Trump a win on the eve of the 2020 election. This is really a minefield for the Democrats, and we're seeing it play out not just in the Democratic debate last night, but really playing out in real terms in Washington in the House of Representatives.
And Matt, the strategy of the Sanders campaign, and they've said this many times, is really predicated on firing up the base and really energizing young voters who tend not to vote as heavily as older voters to get those young voters to the polls. And they feel that they can make some inroads with some blue-collar workers in the Midwest who voted for Trump. But it's clear that energizing the base is really their message. Do you think that's going to be an effective strategy?
It will be effective in one way. We know that activists, those who are more partisan, are the ones who are more likely to vote. We know they're also the ones that are more likely to contribute money to candidates. This is one reason that Bernie Sanders is so adept at raising lots of money in small bills. They dominate social media, and they're particularly active in primaries. But both Linda and Ted have made an important point here. When you look at the evidence of what happened in 2018, it wasn't the activists on the extremes that led to the Democrats retaking the House. It was those women in particular running in those suburbs, more purple districts, that did that. And if you look long term over the last several national elections and you think about the two major parties, what you're seeing here is a growing disjunction between the more extreme views of our political class, the individuals who are running for office, and the more centrist views of the voters. And what this has led to is a series of elections in which the voters have expressed dissatisfaction with whichever party is in power. And so I think Bernie's strategy makes sense, particularly in the primaries, but it's a high-risk strategy, particularly if you're depending on, as you pointed out, a voting cohort, younger voters that historically don't turn out. The one other element I would add, too, picking up on Ted's earlier point, if you're going to recreate the Obama coalition, you have to appeal to racial minorities, and many, particularly older blacks, are more socially conservative. You know, they may be liberal on economic issues, but socially they're often very conservative. So it is a very difficult needle to thread.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Rob, who's calling from Essex Junction. Hi, Rob. What's on your mind today?
Well, I want to take off on your introduction, which was about this debate about progressive and centrist candidates. And, you know, I'm a progressive, and you know, voting for centrists has got us a corporate, for-profit everything. I think Elizabeth Warren did by far the best job of pointing that out when it came to the corrupt NRA, for example. There is corruption endemic, and it's centrists are going to continue that, not willingly, but knowingly. And we're not going to solve any problems with another centrist. Thank you.
All right, Rob, are you still there? Rob, have we lost you? I was curious to see how Rob would feel about Joe Biden if he's the candidate. And that's going to be, you know, if a progressive candidate is the nominee of the party, what will some of the moderates do, and how will that affect the outcome of the election? Let's talk to Lorraine, who's calling from St. Johnsbury. Hi, Lorraine. Welcome to the program.
Hello, everybody. I'm currently reading Falter by Bill McKibben. Has the human game begun to play itself out? I highly recommend it. As far as I'm concerned, climate change is the issue, because all these other issues are nothing if we don't survive on this planet. And I also have a few comments about Medicare for All. I am an elder. I do have Medicare. And let me tell you something, it doesn't cover eyes, teeth, or hearing. And what's the message to us elders? To see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil?
All right, Lorraine, thank you very much for your phone call. And Linda, as we were talking about earlier, most of the other countries that have single payer do have private insurance for a number of other procedures.
That's correct. I think Canada and France don't cover everything, even though they do have universal coverage. Could I change the conversation a little bit about designating these 10 candidates as the leading candidates? The ones like Cory Booker and whatever, the difference between a Cory Booker and a Steve Butt, now I'm blanking on his name, the governor of Montana, is like 2 percentage points. Mm-hmm. Bullock, right, thank you. And what we really had on the stage last night were 3, maybe 5 candidates that look like they could stay in for the long haul. And then a group of people who were quite articulate, like Booker, who don't seem to be able to get anywhere close to being considered a leading candidate, even though they got to be on the stage last night. So the question for me is really about this whole process of the televised debates and the way in which a leading candidate is being described as in terms of fundraising and standing in the polls. And I think it's been premature. It's been troubling to me that probably one of the most electable and most capable politicians, Hickenlooper, dropped out because he didn't make the threshold. I think we've been denied hearing some very useful things from somebody like him. So, but you're in the media. You're complicit in this. So talk to me about it.
Well, Linda, let me ask you this. I've heard some comments from folks who say the best quality or the most important quality for the next president of the United States might not be their debating skills.
Right.
And to choose a candidate based on their debating skills might be a mistake. Are you thinking that's true as well?
Well, yeah. I'm looking at governing. Who's had experience governing? And actually, what's the wonderful campaign line in a woman recently elected governor? Fix the damn potholes. And I think there's a sense in which we have been celebrating positions and plans, and there hasn't been enough attention paid to what people actually can get done.
Bob, if I can jump in there very quickly.
Absolutely.
Linda's absolutely right. When you go on the campaign trail and follow these candidates around, and I've been doing that in New Hampshire, this is the distinction that candidates like Amy Klobuchar and John Hickenlooper, I happen to attend an event, or Pete Buttigieg, a mayor, They are saying we are about accomplishments. Look at our record. See what we've gotten done. Hickenlooper was very strong on saying in a bipartisan fashion he had addressed issues in Colorado dealing with gun control. He got a bipartisan bill on stronger background checks, for instance, through. He did spending on infrastructure, and he was able to work with the opposition party to do that. That message is not so far been enough to get them on the debate stage, and it may say something, I think, as Linda's absolutely right, about the criteria we're using to narrow this field down. Is it the criteria that actually helps us get the best candidates for the presidency? And I think the answer could be no.
And Matt, what would be a better process?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, one of the transitions into this modern era is we've reduced the ability of the party as a campaign organization to vet their own candidates and determine who should run in the party's name. It used to be the, you know, for all the criticism of the back room smoke-filled, they actually chose candidates that they thought could win in a general election. As we've moved towards this more open process, one that's dominated more by, you know, social media and activists who have spending money in small bills, the accomplishments of candidates often begins pushed aside, and they're more interested in candidates who adhere to principle. So purists begin to dominate the race. And, you know, far be it from me to solve this problem, but I think there has to be a better role here for the party elders to serve a screening process. But of course, when they did that, and for instance, think about superdelegates, they got holy hell because that was an elitist process that shut out the rank and file voters. So there's a deep conundrum here.
And Ted, this year, the superdelegates, after the criticism that Matt mentioned in 2016, the superdelegates don't vote on the first ballot, but they are allowed to vote on the second ballot. And how does that start to change things? Does that say, okay, if we can't find somebody on the first ballot, then we need the party elders to come in and help us out here?
And I echo what Matt says. This was introduced to be a moderating influence to a series of unelectable Democrats in the 60s and 70s and 80s. People, you know, superdelegates have this, you know, as Matt said, undemocratic connotation, but they're people who are dedicated to the party. They have shed blood and sweat and tears for the party for decades, former presidents, former governors, congressmen. They know a little something about governing and about government and about politics, and they have the best interests of the party in mind. Maintaining some influence of the superdelegates, even if it's in the second round, I think is a way of maintaining absolutely some of this moderating influence. If we get to the summer of 2020 and we don't have if we have a split ticket among two or three or four people come the Democratic National Convention next summer.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Ann in Manchester. Hi, Ann. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I just want to back up a little bit to the Medicare for All. I am a Medicare recipient. I had a stem cell transplant 4.5 years ago at Dana-Farber, and when I called up to find out what I needed to do for payment, they asked, do you have Medicare or do you have the government one or the private one? And I said, no, I have the government Medicare. And they said, and she said, good. And I said, well, why do you say that? And she said, it's good because regarding a stem cell transplant, which my bills are probably up to $2 million, Medicare pays for that. Medicare Advantage has a pre-authorization. Anytime an insurance company has a pre-authorization, they have the ability to say no. And I said, well, what's your experience with that? And she said, oftentimes at the end of the month, it may be somebody at the same age, female, because I was 68 at the time, and they will get accepted or they will just get rejected. And she said, from a medical record standpoint, they look the same. They're, healthy going into the stem cell transplant. So anyway, that's my personal experience, and it's too bad that people don't get a sense of what Medicare does in the positive sense.
All right, Bill, and we really appreciate you sharing your experience so that folks can understand that. Linda, we're almost out of time, but it's really interesting to note that Bernie Sanders does very well with young voters. Elizabeth Warren does very well with older voters. Why do you think that's the case?
It's an interesting conundrum because younger voters, you'd think they might be attracted to Mayor Pete, for example. And there's something about Bernie's kind of in-your-face persona. Young people really put a high premium on authenticity. And I think that the fact that he's been consistent over the years and that he says things that he knows will be unpopular is very attractive to the youngest among our voters. The attraction to Elizabeth Warren, I think it has to do with the fact that she's a very good explainer. And she makes complicated things understandable in plain English. She must have been a very good law professor.
Well, this has been a great discussion today. Many thanks to our panel, Linda Fowler, Matt Dickinson, and Ted Cohn. Thank you all very much for a great discussion.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.